Hi guys, I'm Danielle Grossmanite. So all of my announcements. One, the computer for sign up is going to be in the back room this week, not over here. At the end for cleanup, just make sure that the chairs are around the table like they were when we came in. That's very important. I don't think there's any weekly announcements about anything special going on this week, unless I feel like I would know that. Oh, great. So thank you guys for coming. It's a good week for me to be the one who's speaking instead of Danielle, because the speaker is my father, Rabbi Haber. Other than being my father, which is probably his biggest accomplishment, my father was one of the... Thank you. My father was one of the founders of MMY. He taught there for 16 years. Currently, he is a freelance rabbi and tour guide. Teaches in TVA, MTVA, tours wherever he can. And that's it.
That was some introduction. Wow. Okay. Well, first of all, it's just really, really impressive and exciting to see such a large group. Really, really says a lot about your community that such a number of people come out to learn voluntarily on a night when you have, you know, classes the next day, etc. So kol hakavod lachem. I debated what topic to speak about tonight. Part of me wanted to come and give a shiur on the parsha, and there's lots to talk about in the parsha, or something connected to Eretz Yisrael as a tour guide, or some other topic that's, you know, interesting. Someone that I consulted with called it boring. That was Batsheva, I think, right? It called it boring. Also, I guess, hopefully not boring, simply safe. And ultimately, I opted to talk about a topic which is somewhat controversial, I guess, and definitely timely. I assume that... everyone here is aware that about 2 weeks ago in the United States, the Rabbinical Council of America made a statement that generated a lot of controversy, and that a lot of people have been talking about for the last 2 weeks. I'm not going to address that specific issue directly. Much has been said about it by many people, including me, and if anyone is interested in what I have to say about it, I have a post on my blog that was republished in a few places where you can see it. But that's not directly what I want to talk about tonight. Instead, I want to take a step back. And I want to address there are several fundamental issues. Let me say this, one statement about that controversy, and that is that there really are two sides, and perhaps there are extremists on both sides whose positions are extreme, but there are also balanced people on both sides, at least in my view, there really are two sides, and there's a lot to talk about. So instead of talking about that, what I want to do is I want to take a step back and address one of several, perhaps the most important of several, maybe not the most important, but one of several fundamental issues that underlines not only this controversy, but a lot of other debates that go on nowadays about the role of women in halakha and the way in which halakha responds to modernity or post-modernity. I hope it'll be helpful. A few preliminary comments. First of all, this shiur is going to have a very long introduction. Don't worry, the introduction will take up about a third or so of the shiur, maybe even a little more than that. But that doesn't mean it's going to be a four-hour shiur. It'll be the introduction is a significant part of it. And I also want to just say that the conclusions I'm going to ultimately come to here are my own opinion. I'm convinced that they're true. That's why I'm saying them. But they're my opinion, and you're welcome to disagree, and I welcome anyone here who wants to challenge or dispute or anything I want to say. But how about if we, let me get through the presentation first, and I'll make sure there's some time at the end for any comments, questions, disagreements, or anything of that sort. Not directly. If that's really actually happened, then kol hakavod, you must be learning, have your head in a Gemara or in your physics text, or I don't know what. But But someone can fill you in. It's not directly relevant. And if I start it, we're not going to stop it, so I'm not going to stop it. Okay. So the title of the shiur is Egalitarian or Patriarchal on Gender Roles in Halakha. And Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehi Bevo. I want to spend a certain amount of time defining those terms. Okay, I took those terms. Those are not my terms. Those are terms that are commonly used in contemporary discourse, particularly feminist discourse. They're terms that are very, very central to feminist ideology. I personally do not, unlike my daughter, do not define myself as a feminist. I do not directly identify with the feminist movement, although I do agree with and identify with many of the goals and ideals of that movement, both the general feminist movement and, I guess, what's called the Orthodox feminist movement, but I also disagree and hold back from some of them. So I'm not coming here as a feminist to discuss those terms, but let's take a look at those two terms. Feminism, or feminist thought, at least, you know, often uses these two terms, egalitarian and patriarchal, to describe two different models of society. The egalitarian one being the one that feminism says is good, and the patriarchal one being bad. And the question that arises is whether, I like to use the term halakha, some people, or Torah, others might use the term Orthodox Judaism, which is a term I don't like to use as much, but I guess they mean the same thing. Whether halakha and Torah is a patriarchal system, which therefore relegates women to a lower status than men, and if so, that very much conflicts with the way most of us think nowadays, and what do we do about that? Those are the questions, but let's first define those two terms. So egalitarian and then patriarchal. So what does egalitarian mean? And here's the lengthy introduction. So an egalitarian society, egalitarian from the word equal, right, is one in which all people, regardless not only of gender, but also regardless of race, religion, national origin, political opinion, sexual orientation, or any other categories that people can be put into, all people are meant to be, in an egalitarian society, treated exactly the same. They're meant to have equal rights. They're meant to have equal status under the law, equal opportunities to be treated equally. That's what egalitarian means, and it's hard to express any negative sentiments about such a concept. I think it's something that we all intrinsically feel is just and correct and right. There is one important detail, though, that needs to be understood about egalitarianism in terms of the way that term is understood in contemporary Western culture. And that is a principle that was laid down very clearly by the United States Supreme Court in 1954 in a landmark decision called Brown versus Board of Education, in which what happened was this is after the black slaves, after slavery had ended and after the United States Constitution demanded equal treatment for blacks and for whites, which, of course, in parts of the United States was not always the case, but by 1954 it certainly was. And there was a school district in Kansas that had separate public schools for blacks and for whites. And somebody, who I assume was black, Mr. Brown, I guess was his name, sued the Board of Education and said that this was against the law because you're supposed to have equal treatment and you have segregated schools. My children, the black children, have to go to one school and the white children to another school. And the school district argued that it was not in violation of that law because it said we have to give equal treatment. And we are. We have a school for the blacks, we have a school for the whites, and they claim that they have equal, I don't know the details of the case, but in theory they were arguing that they have the same budgets and the same, you know, that it's equal. It's just one school for blacks and one school for whites, but we're not disadvantaging the blacks at all. And the Supreme Court struck that down and laid, not just in that particular case, not just in that particular case and said that in this case it won't be equal if, but the Supreme Court established as an axiom, as a principle, that there is no such thing as separate but equal. If it's separate, it's not equal. And I don't know if it's because of that decision, but that principle has become very, very much ingrained in contemporary thinking, such that when the term egalitarian is used today, it means not only that people have to be given equal status, but people have to be given identical status. Now, you can agree with or disagree with that, but I want to point out that the definition of egalitarianism includes that point, which in theory it didn't necessarily need to. So much has this association that there's no such thing as separate but equal sort of penetrated our consciousness or our whole culture that, take for example an English word, discrimination. That's a bad word, right? But what does the word discriminate mean? English, what does the word discriminate mean? It means to differentiate or to distinguish, right? But so much has the concept that any discrimination, any distinction is automatically bad, that when we talk about this, if I say I discriminate, what's the next word always? Against, right? I discriminate, you've discriminated against someone, when in theory one should be able, in theory at least, to distinguish, to discriminate between things without necessarily automatically discriminating against somebody. But in the way the term is used in contemporary society, if you discriminated between, like the Supreme Court decided, right? There's no such thing as separate but equal. If you've discriminated between people, you've automatically discriminated against someone. So that's where the egalitarian concept starts from. Okay, that's how the term egalitarian is used, at least in contemporary discourse. That's egalitarian. Now, what's patriarchal? So the patriarchy is a term that feminists use to describe a very non-egalitarian way of organizing society, a system that was very, very common in pre-modern societies, particularly tribal societies, and that certainly still exists in some parts of the world, in which societies organized in terms of a hierarchy, and where feminists talk about the fact that in a patriarchal system, men have a higher status than women, which they certainly do. That's not the only lack of equality that exists in patriarchal societies. There are others as well, meaning men have a higher status than women, but there are some men, for example, that have a higher status than other men, right? The tribe is led by the elders, the Ziknei HaShevet, who have all the power and all the control, not because they're elected leaders or anything like that, but because they stand at the top of the pyramid. Within a family in a patriarchal society, the eldest son has a much higher status than all the younger. The Bechor has a much higher status than all the others. Women also, there are different status. You could be a wife or you could be a concubine. Those are different statuses. There are slaves, right? It's a non-egalitarian society where people have different, some people by virtue of their birth, by virtue of their gender, by virtue of their family, people have a status that's higher than others. If you want to get a description of what patriarchal society was like, you can actually read Sefer Bereishit, right? Our patriarchs actually lived in a patriarchal society, right? The Avot, right? The ancient Near East where the Avot lived. If you read just the background of what's going on, think, for example, about what we read 2 weeks ago when the servant was sent to get a wife for Yitzchak and the negotiations that take place. It's very clear what's going on there. This is the context. The context is this type of society. Avraham needs a wife for his son. He decides he wants it. So he sends a servant to this clan. They don't go talk to the boy or the girl, but they certainly don't talk to the girl. They talk to the father and the older brother, right? Lavan, the brother has a key role there, and there's a whole negotiation that goes on, and they basically decide who Rivka is going to marry. So that's an example of a patriarchal society. Now, if you listen to feminists describe the patriarchy or patriarchal societies, they will typically describe the patriarchy as a system that not only places women at a lower status than men, but that was designed for that purpose, right? Its purpose is to ensure men power or control over women and to make sure that women are controlled by men. Without denying that that's at least sometimes what happens in a patriarchal society, I think that that's highly oversimplified at least. Meaning, if we want to address this topic, we've got to understand where did that come from in the first place? Why is it that, before we get to today, and before we get to the Torah either, why is it that, for example, in the ancient Near East, like in many other parts of the world, that's the way it was? That society had this hierarchy, and that a central part of the hierarchy is that men had a higher status than women, and that women were sort of subservient to the men. Why? Where did that come from, and why did it happen? It happened, I think at least, and based on my understanding, because of certain very real necessities that sort of made it a necessity, right? There were certain realities of life that led to the reality that women needed to be protected and provided for. Why? First of all, because once upon a time, in order to deal with most basic necessities of life, like food, like obtaining food, required a lot of physical strength. It's a fact of nature that on average men are physically stronger than women, and particularly when women need to be involved with bearing children, with raising children, with becoming pregnant, to go out and work in the fields to bring home your bread, a pregnant woman is not going to be able to do that. And when society needs women to be the ones to take care of small children, because until just a few decades ago, the only way for a baby to eat was from his mother's milk. There was no other food available until a few decades ago that you could feed a baby. And not to mention that babies used to be exclusively fed breast milk until the age of two, until modern medicine decided that we should start giving them other, or develop the ability to give them other foods earlier. So if we're going to have a next generation, we need the women to be, first of all, the women who anyway are going to have a harder time providing for themselves or protecting themselves against attackers anyway need to be protected. And if we're going to have a next generation, we need the women to be pregnant and nursing and taking care of the children, and then they certainly can't provide for themselves and they certainly can't protect themselves and their children. So a system evolved wherein that's what happened, and the men were protected the women and took care of the women, provided for the women, and therefore became those who also made decisions. And I assume that that's where it came from. And also we can then understand why things are so different nowadays. Baruch Hashem. Because a lot of what led to that is no longer true. First of all, most people, at least in our societies, most people earn their living today not with their bodies but with their minds. That's a result of the Industrial Revolution, and now we live in a post-industrial world where, you know, so it's physical strength is much less of a factor, thank you. It still means something, but it's much less of a factor. And not to mention also that, you know, we also have, even first of all, we have now other things that we can feed to young children, and we also have refrigeration. So even if a baby is going to have his mother's milk, he doesn't have to necessarily have his mother next to him every few hours. There are ways to preserve the milk, etc. And therefore, things like that and many other technological changes, etc., have certainly changed the realities of life and have created greater opportunities for all of us, and certainly have leveled the playing fields very, very much between men and women, which I think we can all agree is a positive thing. And that's where we're now able to come along and say, okay, so those old ways of doing things are no longer relevant, perhaps. But I don't know that we have to say that the patriarchal system was, by definition, created for the sake of oppressing women. And I think also it depends on the society. There are patriarchal societies where women are owned by their husbands, abused by everybody, etc. But if you look, go back to the story we talked about. If you look at the way, and I'm not talking here about our avot that I have perhaps some, you know, psychological or other need to defend. If you talk about Lavan and Betuel and their family, if you look at the way they dealt with Rivka, you know, when he said that it was time for her to go and he was going to take her back with him, and they thought, no, she should stay for a while, they asked her permission. Right? Do you want to go or do you want to stay? And when she said, I'll go, only then did they agree to let her go. And they gave her a wonderful bracha. you know, there's this emotional scene where they're parting from their beloved daughter and wishing her atayil al fir of avach uteinu, and also the way Lavan later talks about his own daughters. I don't know that there was necessary oppression going on there, but it's certainly a system that doesn't jive well with us, and I don't think any of us would want to go back to living in such a society. Okay, so with some caveats now, we've defined the term egalitarian and the term patriarchal, these two poles. And the feminists will tell you also that, of course, these are two poles on a scale that things can be somewhat somewhere in the middle also. But now let's ask the question, now that we've defined our terms, whether the Torah system is egalitarian or whether it's patriarchal, and if it is not egalitarian and or is patriarchal, what do we do about that? But before I get to that, one last statement as part of this introduction. And again, I'm speaking for myself. I approach this topic as someone who cares very deeply about the truth, who believes very strongly, ani ma'amin b'emunah shlema, that the Torah is divine, that the Torah was given to us on Har Sinai, and by that I mean both the Torah shebichtav and the Torah shebal peh, which means everything that comes through Torah shebal peh, including the Mishnah and the Gemara and all of the interpretations, down to the leaders of our own generation who are, according to my understanding, the authentic continuation of the system of Torah shebal peh. I believe b'emunah shlema that this is from Hashem and is divine and is true. And I also believe very strongly that if that's the case, then the Torah has to be good and the Torah has to be just. We can't have a system where the Torah is unjust. Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. Such a thing is unfathomable. And therefore, if I'm faced with, before I get to any details, if I'm faced with what appears at least to be a contradiction, where the Torah seems to be saying something that to me seems unjust, so I have to figure out what to do about that. And there are different approaches. Some people will engage in apologetics, where they'll try to restate everything in such a way and kind of paper over differences. Some people, including some of my daughters, have accused me of doing that from time to time. I try very hard not to and don't believe that I do, but I'll let you judge. But that's certainly one approach. Another approach, if one feels that the Torah is doing something which is unjust, is to say, okay, it's unjust, we have to change it. And frankly, that's what non-Orthodox movements have done. Either openly, like Reform Judaism declaring that halakha is not binding and that Reform Judaism actually developed a whole theology about how the Torah is supposed to change from generation to generation. Or like Conservative Judaism, which claimed that it wasn't doing that, but actually did do that, and I'm not going to discuss the basis for the statement I just made now. That's a separate discussion. But I think that's a very defensible statement. If one is not willing to do that either, though, meaning if one is not willing to paper over any problems and say that they're not problems, or alternatively to declare that they are problems and take action, then the only other possibility is to take a model which is formulated on a different issue by Rav Sadia Gaon and later on by the Rambam when they faced contradictions of a slightly different type. Both Rav Sadia Gaon and the Rambam and other medieval rationalist philosophers had this system that they called philosophy, rational philosophy it's called today, and they believed that through philosophical inquiry of the type that was in vogue in the Middle Ages that they could come to absolute proofs of absolute truth. Sort of the way we think about science today. You could prove things, and if you prove them, they must be true. And Rav Sadia Gaon asked, and the Rambam later wrote something similar in his Hakdama to the Moran, the Rav Sadia Gaon talks about this in his Sefer Emunot V'Deot, and the Rambam later on in the Moran Nevuchim, what do you do if you feel that science has proven X, and the Torah seems to be saying Y, and X and Y contradict one another? What do you do in such a situation? And both of them made the same ultimate decision, which is, such a contradiction is impossible, because truth cannot contradict truth. And if I've proved scientifically that it's true, or philosophically that it's true, then it is true. If the Torah says it, then it is true. And truth cannot contradict truth. And therefore, if there is a contradiction between what I've proven philosophically or scientifically and what it says in the Torah, then that contradiction is the result of a mistake. And the mistake could be one of two things, or maybe one of three. If I've proven something philosophically, but the Torah says otherwise, then maybe I should go back and check my proof again. Maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I thought I proved something, and maybe I should look at my data again and see if I really did prove it. Maybe there was a mistake in the reasoning. And if that's not the case, then maybe I misunderstood what the Torah was saying. Maybe the Torah wasn't saying what I thought it said. You know, the Rambam said, you know, anyone who opens the Torah and reads it thinks God has a body. Torah says so. It describes all of his body parts. He has a hand, he has fingers, he has a nose, he has feet and legs, and et cetera, et cetera. But the Rambam and many other philosophers came to the conclusion that it's impossible for God to have a body. So they then came along and said something that today we take as such a obvious point, but that was anything but obvious when this statement was made. They burned the Rambam's books in the streets of France because of this statement, because it was seen as so heretical, that the Torah must not have meant what we thought it meant. That when the Torah said that, used expressions like that, it must be meant allegorically or something like that. So one or the other, either what I thought was proven scientifically wasn't really proven scientifically, or what I thought the Torah was saying isn't really what the Torah is saying, or maybe both. But something's got to give because there can't be a contradiction. That's what the medieval Jewish philosophers like Reb Sadegon and the Rambam did when it came to philosophy. That's what a lot of us do today when it comes to science. An issue like, is the world 5,700 and something years plus 6 days old, or is the world, 4.5 billion years old? And I think we use similar methodology to resolve those types of contradictions. It's trickier to do that with the type of thing I'm talking about. But if, after very careful thought, I come to the conclusion that something is demanded by the needs of justice, and I come to the conclusion that the Torah says otherwise, something has to give. And either I'm going to have to look back and see, in this case, I'll start with, maybe the Torah wasn't saying what I thought the Torah was saying? Or else I'm going to have to conclude that what I thought was just was not justice. Maybe I don't understand it. But ha-shofet kol aretz lo yaseh mishpat, I can't accept that there's an injustice here. That's my approach. Again, in a few minutes, let me just finish this. Give me another 15, 20 minutes. We'll go through it, and then I'll take all comments and questions, okay? So that's the background. That's the introduction. Now, let's ask the question, okay? Don't worry. We're about halfway done already. I told you. Let's ask the question. Is the Torah egalitarian, or is the Torah, or halacha, or Orthodox Judaism, whatever term you want to use, patriarchal? Let's start with the question, is it egalitarian? I think the only legitimate answer to that question is no. At least, if we use the term egalitarian in the way it's used today, which I described earlier. Because the Torah does, at times, discriminate, at least between, men and women. There are halachot in the Torah that address men and women differently, assign responsibilities, different rights, different status to men and women. The halacha is not purely egalitarian. Now, an important point should be made here, which doesn't take anything away from the statement that I just said, but it's often overlooked. And that is that the great majority of mitzvot in the Torah, the overwhelming majority, actually don't distinguish between men and women. I never did the math, and if somebody'd like to do this, I'd be interested in the result. I just never have had the time. You haven't figured that? Okay. You can do it easily. You can take the Sefer Achinuch, which counts all 613 mitzvot, and each one tells you if it relates to men and women. Batsheva says she has the answer. It depends how you calculate it also. But the number of mitzvot that distinguish between men and women directly is fairly small. Now, it depends how you count it, because, for example, there's a whole set of mitzvot that apply only to Kohanim, and Kohanim cannot be women. So one could argue that all those mitzvot distinguish between men and women. Or one could argue, no, they don't. They distinguish between Kohanim and non-Kohanim, meaning those mitzvot don't apply to any of the women in the room. They don't apply to me either. So depends how you count it. But whatever the math is, the great majority of mitzvot in the Torah, and in a minute we'll talk about what some of those are, do not in any way distinguish between men and women. So we're talking about a small section of the mitzvot in the Torah, but that doesn't perhaps matter because it still exists. And there are a number of laws, including some very central ones to our lives, that definitely distinguish, differentiate, or discriminate, whichever word you prefer, between men and women. So at least using the contemporary definition of egalitarian, we cannot say that the Torah at least is not purely egalitarian. And one could argue, I think quite convincingly, that if it's not purely egalitarian, then it's not egalitarian at all. So what do I do with that? So one possibility is to declare that the Torah is sexist and suppresses women. But I'm not prepared to make such a statement, as I told you. It flies in the face of everything I believe in. HaShofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. I certainly cannot so flippantly make such a comment. There are problems, and I'll get to them. But I cannot flippantly make such a comment. And therefore, my other possibility is to suggest that perhaps the Torah is egalitarian according to a different definition. Maybe the Torah doesn't accept Brown versus Board of Education. Maybe the Torah claims, which is the same thing as saying the truth is, if you believe in the Torah, maybe, that there is such a thing as separate but equal. Now, that doesn't automatically mean, but if I concede such a statement, I haven't yet determined that that's what's going on here. But can I countenance the possibility that there can be laws that say, okay, men are in this category and women are in this category and they have different responsibilities and they have different rights and they have different roles and they have different authorities? And is it possible to make such a statement without automatically discriminating against women? I mean, let me put it to you in different terms. The United States Supreme Court could have ruled against the Kansas Board of Education, theoretically, without setting down an axiomatic principle. They could have said that maybe separate could be equal, but in this case it's not. They chose not to. They chose to make the statement that separate is by definition unequal. Perhaps, however, and it seems to me that this is the way to go if I want to look at the Torah in this way, perhaps one can say the opposite. One can say that separate could be equal. Of course, it may also be unequal. And therefore, if we do that, we've certainly decided that the Torah is not egalitarian by today's terms, by feminist terms, by Western society's norms of today. But perhaps the Torah is telling us something about what true egalitarianism is. And then we need to see whether that makes any sense based on the data. So let's go on. It's not egalitarian, at least by today's standards, but maybe it's a different form of egalitarian. Is it patriarchal? And here, I think the only fair answer is yes. I think it is, in at least certain aspects of it. Now again, first of all, I'm using the term patriarchal in the descriptive sense as I understand it, and not the way it's used in contemporary feminist discourse, where immediately, if it's patriarchal, it's evil. But there certainly are halachot that have such a hierarchical system, and in a minute, we're going to look at the source sheet, and we're going to see some examples of those, which place men not only in a different status as women, but give men certain powers that women don't have. There's a hierarchy. There's a patriarchy. Now, it's, again, important to point also that we shouldn't overstate the case. Not only do most of the mitzvot in the Torah not distinguish between men and women, but women have always had certain basic rights in halakha that perhaps they don't have in certain patriarchal societies. Just to give you a few examples, it has always been a crime, for example, to murder a woman exactly the same as to murder a man, or to attack a woman has been a crime, whether the attacker is her husband or anyone else. It has always been a crime. Damages against a woman or her property have always been treated by halakha. A woman can go to court and sue someone else for damages, even including her own husband. It's always been prohibited for husbands to beat their wives, to rape their wives. Husbands have never been viewed in halakha as the owner of their wives. So whatever might exist in some patriarchal societies has never been the case in halakha. But maybe that just means we were less patriarchal. The fact still remains that there definitely are halachot, including some of the issues that are behind the whole controversy over the recent RCA statement, which can only be defined as patriarchal. So the question is, what do we do about that? Now, even if I concede that separate might be equal, but there are halachot that seem to say that it's definitely not equal. And in order to understand this, I think what we need to do, in order to grapple with this issue, I think we need to look at the various halachot or the various mitzvot in the Torah and break them down into categories. One could go through, I guess, all 613 plus all the mitzvot d'rabbanan and put them into categories. We're not going to do that now, but let's take a look at a few examples. Perhaps let's sketch out what the categories are and then approach them. And then we're done and I'll take questions and comments, okay? So the first category is the easiest one to deal with, and those are the mitzvot in the Torah, which I think are the majority, the great majority perhaps, that don't differentiate between men and women at all, don't discriminate between men and women at all, the ones in which men and women are treated exactly the same, like, for example, the ones they talked about, that you're not allowed to, you know, murder a woman or a man, it doesn't matter, that's an egalitarian law, certainly not patriarchal, etc. And by the way, this also includes many mitzvot, many fundamental obligations, the obligations of keeping Shabbat, of keeping kosher, certain aspects of tefillah, tzedakah, etc., etc., etc. So those are easy. Those are egalitarian, non-patriarchal laws. We don't need to talk about those. There are also laws, though, that sound patriarchal, but really aren't. And why would that happen? I'm going to give you an example in a minute. There are halachot which themselves are not patriarchal at all, or at the very least are not discriminatory against women at all, but sound very much like they are when you read the texts. And the reason for that, and I'm going to give you an example in a second. The reason why this happens is that we have to remember that when the Torah was given, and when the halachic texts were formulated in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara, and much, much later on also, the context was a patriarchal society. That wasn't something the Torah created. That was a reality. And therefore, there are halachot that in their formulation, the way they're presented in the Mishnah, the way they're presented in the Gemara, the way they're presented in Shulchan Aruch in some cases, reflect a patriarchal reality, not because that's the halacha, but because that was the application of the halacha to the realities at the time. And although the halacha does not change at all, when one applies the halacha to different circumstances, one gets a very different result. Let me give you an example of that. Let's talk about a marriage. The halacha defines relationships between husbands and wives in many different contexts. Let's talk about the financial relationships of a marriage. If you look at the first source on your sheet, the first source lists, it's from the Shulchan Aruch, and it lists a husband's financial or economic rights vis-a-vis his wife. And it says that there are four things, four ways in which a husband can acquire property through his wife. Ve'elu hein ha'arba, first source on the page there, Evan Ezer, Hilchot Ketubot, Siman Samech Tet, Se'iv Gimel, Elahin Arba'a, Ma'aseh Yadeha, if I'm married, right? If my wife goes to work and earns a salary, so according to this halacha, as her husband, that salary belongs to me. She comes home from work, I say, thank you, dear, take the paycheck and it's mine. Mitziyata, she's walking down the street and finds something in the street and picks it up, it's mine, as her husband. Peroteha, if she owns property that produces a profit. It could be a field that produces produce. It could be stocks that produce dividends or whatever. I get those. Virushata. And I don't want to say my... If someone's wife's father dies and she would inherit the property, he would get it. The husband gets it also. Right? Anything, basically any income the wife has belongs to the husband. That sounds very patriarchal, right? He's her husband. She works and he gets her paycheck. But when you read the fine print, it turns out that that's not what's going on at all. Look at the next halacha. Ma'aseh yadeha k'neged mizonoteha. The system that the halacha set up, which is still on the books, is that a husband is obligated to support his wife. She's not obligated to work. You get married, You have to support your wife. It's in the ksuba. Now, the halacha, trying to be fair to the husband, says, well, okay, if I'm responsible to support her and I have to pay all of her expenses, then it's only fair that if there's income, right, it shouldn't be that I have to pay all of her expenses, right, and I have to break my back and buy her clothes and buy her food and buy her all this, and then she goes out and has a job and takes the money and she can go, you know, do whatever she wants with it. If I have to cover the expenses, I'm entitled to the income as well. But what if she doesn't like that arrangement? What if she says, you know what, I'd rather be able to keep my have separate bank accounts, keep my own paycheck, and you don't have to support me. So the halacha is she could say that. Lefikach im amra, eini nuzonet ve'eini osa, shomin la. She has the right to make that decision. I skip the Rama, but to the end there. Aval habal shamar eini zancha ve'eini notel maaseh yadev yadayich. But if a husband says, you know what, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to support you, go support yourself, ain shomin la. He doesn't have the right to do that. Meaning, the system that the halacha set up is that the standard relationship, again, based on the reality that society was organized in a patriarchal way, the standard arrangement was that the husband supports the wife, and he's entitled, therefore, to her income. But it is her option, and not his, to choose an alternate arrangement, which at the time of the Gemara was a very unusual. The Gemara has at least one case of a woman who actually said that, but it was unusual in a patriarchal society. Women didn't typically have the ability to support themselves, so it would be a rare woman who would make such a decision. But she has the right to make that decision unilaterally, to say, I want financial independence. Now, it works both ways. If you have financial independence, you get to keep your income, but then you can't also, it's fair to both sides. But if anyone's discriminated against here, it's the husband. Meaning the, so why am I using this example? This is a classic example. I love this example because when you first read the halacha, it gets you angry. It seems so anti-woman. And if anything, the rabbis here protected the woman to the point that, if anything, there's a party in Israel today called the Men's Rights Party. They run every time the Knesset and always lose. And they claim that the women's, you know, laws favor women in like divorce cases and stuff like that. They could use this, right? If anything. I mean, I don't know that that's, maybe that's overstating the case. But if anybody's discriminated against here, it's the man, not the woman. But you have to read the fine print to get that point, and you have to be able to get past certain psychological biases to see that. But I think it's undeniable. This is a halakha that when I first read it, and I said, as the husband, I'm entitled to all my wife's income, it sounds so oppressive to women, and it's really not at all. It's really not at all. It's a fair system, which is formulated in such a way, again, the texts, you have to read the fine print to get to that, because at the time the texts were written down, almost no woman would choose that of her own volition. Those were the realities of life. It was a patriarchal world, but the halacha wasn't enforcing the patriarchy on this issue. I'm not denying that there are cases where it does. I'll get to those. But on this issue and on others like it, the halacha is not enforcing the patriarchy. The halacha is simply creating options, and what was at one point almost always chosen today, you know, most couples have some kind of joint financial arrangement, and when it does come, unfortunately, to divorce cases, and but they then have to deal with financial arrangements in marriage, they reflect the realities of life today, and no Beit Din, whatever problems there are with Batei Din, which I'll touch on briefly in a few minutes, my understanding is that no Beit Din, you know, enforces these laws in this way, because because marriage is an agreement between the two parties, and the assumptions in which people go into marriages today are different. So this is a situation where the texts reflect a certain historical reality that was never enforced by halakha, and therefore when Batei Din today apply these laws differently, they're not changing anything. They're applying the same halakha to today's circumstances, and once you understand that, this whole category of laws also falls out of the conversation. Okay? So there are laws that don't even look patriarchal. There are laws that might look patriarchal but aren't. And then there are those that really are. So let's talk about some of those. Here, within those laws, which really do distinguish intrinsically between men and women, or maybe even discriminate against women, one might say, these also have to be divided into different categories. And the most difficult ones to deal with are the ones that are actual, what we call dinim d'oraita, where there's a law that Torah Shabbat Peh has taught us is an absolute law that comes from the Torah, therefore can never be changed. and needs to be understood as reflecting some sort of divine truth. Let's take a look at one of those. Women are pasul eidut. And we have here a Mishnah and a Gemara Masechet Shavuot. And the Mishnah says that comes through it from sort of from the side door about something called Shavuot Ha'edut, which I won't get into now, but basically the Gemara says here very clearly, based on a pasuk, it says, Ve'amdu shnei ha'anashim ve'edim ha'katuv medaber. The Gemara in Masechet Shavuot learns from the pasuk. When describing witnesses, they're called by the Torah anashim, and even though one could have theoretically said that anashim is just a general term which means people, the Gemara decides to interpret it using the tools of Torah Shabbat Peh as a specific statement that witnesses have to be men. The Rambam quotes this and says explicitly, Nashim psulot leidut min ha-Torah, and it's quoted down that way in Shulchan Aruch as well, that women are not accepted as witnesses in court, and therefore that women cannot also be judges on a court. It means a Beit Din cannot have women dayanot on it. And that seems to be a clear psak in Shulchan Aruch, which is based on a law that sources a Torah law, which means it is what it is and it can never change. That means Batei Din have always been and will always be exclusively male. That's patriarchal. Now, it's interesting to point out, I'll just mention this, it's somewhat related to the current controversy. If you look at the Pitchei Shuvah, because it's getting a little bit late already, I'm not going to go, maybe I won't even read it inside, so I'll read one line inside. The Pitchei Shuvah, very important Acharon, who collects responsa literature that relates to Dinim and the Shulchan Aruch, he says here that Av she isha psula ladun, the end of the first line, Mikom achom isha chachama yichola lahorot hora'ah. Right, that even though a woman cannot serve as a judge in a Beit Din, the question, which is very, very relevant to the current controversy of whether a woman can serve as a poseket halakha, whether a woman who is knowledgeable can issue a halakhic ruling, not in the context of a court case, but in the context of a halakhic ruling on, for example, a matter of isur v'heter or something like that. He quotes here sources that say she can. There are some sources that say a woman can't, and that's part of the current controversy. But in any case, at the very least, to be a dayan on a Beit Din she cannot do, or a judge in a Beit Din. Already in the times of the Gemara, when necessary, they found ways to circumvent that. When it was necessary to get evidence from a female witness, already in the times of the Gemara, there were ways to do that. But the fact still remains that are not accepted as witnesses, at least in the technical sense, in court, and women cannot be Dayanot, which means Batei Din, have to be run by men. What do we do with that? I don't know if I can... I could try to philosophize about it, and in the past I have, and I don't know if it's worth getting into now because it's purely speculative. But either I understand it or I don't. If I believe that the Torah is true, then I accept that there are certain roles that the Torah defined for men and certain roles that the Torah defined for women. And the question is that discriminatory against women? That would very much depend on whether the fact that a woman cannot serve on a Beit Din means that if you feel that, again, if your starting point is that everyone has to have all the same opportunities and saying that there's a certain role that you cannot fill or a certain job you cannot have, then by definition you've discriminated against somebody, then the answer is the Torah is not egalitarian. But can I accept a situation where there are certain roles that only men can fill and not women, and can I be okay with that? That depends on whether, in the final analysis, the results are just or not just. It's a whole separate topic, the question of what goes on today with Batei Din, particularly in divorce cases. I think it's pretty unanimously accepted that there's a real problem today with divorce cases. But I think that the solutions that need to happen include Batei Din acting differently than they do. They don't necessarily have to have women on the Beit Din in order to make that happen. We have to change certain things. Certainly everyone here who gets married should have a prenuptial agreement, that's for sure. I hope that's clear to everybody. In my opinion, there might be even better things that should be done, but at the very least, that should be done. if we solve those problems, and the Dayanim are men, I at least can live with that without much of a problem. But I have to acknowledge there are things that the Torah, there are places where the Torah, for whatever reasons, whether I understand them or not, gives men power that it doesn't give to women. But then there are other, there's another example. And with this, this last example, I'll close this analysis and I'll open up to questions or whatever. There are halachot that on the one hand are not in the category that I mentioned a minute ago, things that look patriarchal but really aren't. They actually are patriarchal. But they also aren't laws that are set in stone and can't change. And a great example of that is a law that already the great rabbis of it several generations ago already declared, a law that its application has to change, a change that's so dramatic that within a span of 2 or 3 generations it has been accepted universally across the spectrum of all Orthodox communities in the world without any exception. And that is the prohibition, and that's what it seems that there once was, against women learning Torah. Today we sometimes talk about whether women can learn Gemara, not can learn Gemara. I teach women Gemara, I have been for 25 years, I have no problem with that either. But the truth of the matter is that if you read carefully, you don't have to read carefully, even read uncarefully. Look at the last source. This is the Shulchan Aruch, source number 6. Okay, source number 6 in the Shulchan Aruch. This is the Shulchan Aruch. This is what it said. Isha shelamda Torah yesh la sachar avaloke sachar ha'ish, mitnei she'en mitzuva v'yosa. Women are not obligated to learn Torah, and therefore, if they learn Torah, they're doing a mitzvah, which is not obligatory for them, and therefore they have reward, but not the same as a man. But then it turns around and says, v'afel pisha yesh la sachar, even though she has a reward for learning Torah, tzivu chazal shelo yilamed adam et bito Torah. The rabbis commanded that we not teach our daughters Torah. Not teach our daughters Torah at all. That's what it says. Mipnei, because, I'm just going to read what it says here. Sherov hanashim, most women ein da'atan mechuvenet lehitlamed. Most women's minds are not capable of being taught. Umotziot divrei Torah ledivrei havai lefi aniyut da'atan. And therefore, if you teach them Torah, since they're not capable of being taught, they will wind up misunderstanding what they're taught and turning the words of Torah into words of nonsense or worse because of their feeble understanding. Amru Chachamim, famous statement, kolam alamed that bito Torah, anyone who teaches his daughter Torah, ke'ilu milamda tiflut. It's as if he taught her tiflut, which some interpret as just nonsense, and others interpret worse. The Shulchan Aruch here says, Perush Dvar Aveir, it's like you taught her immorality because she's going to misunderstand and she's going to think she knows and she's going to figure out all kinds of ways to convince herself that all sorts of things are allowed, and therefore you shouldn't teach her Torah. Bamed Dvar Marmirim, what are we talking about? B'Torah Shebal Peh. You're not supposed to teach your Torah Shebal Peh. Then it's as if you, which doesn't only mean Gemara, by the way, it means Mishnah, it means Shulchan Aruch, it means anything that's not the written Torah, probably Rashi and Chumash also. That's Tiflut. Aval Torah Shebichtav, but the written Torah, Lo Yilamed Otat Lichatchila, you're not supposed to teach your Tanakh or Chumash either, just it's not as bad. Avalim Alamda Eno Kemalamda Tiflut. That's in the Shulchan Aruch. So then the Ramah adds the crucial point that obviously that's not, that she has to learn halacha l'masa because otherwise she won't be able to keep the Torah. And the Ramah writes that in the next thing. Now, the application, this halacha raises a lot of questions, and I could, and if you like, I'm happy to come back another time and give an hour-long shir on this. I'm not going to do that now, okay? Why? What the assumption was based on, why the rabbis assumed that women couldn't understand, I think I have a very clear explanation of that, actually, but not for now. Okay? And it wasn't based on any kind of sexism. And the rabbis themselves understood, right? We all know about Bruria and a few others mentioned already in the Gemara, women who were exceptionally, and then there are a long list of others. And even the language here seems to imply that. Rov Hanashim. I'm not getting into all this now. One thing, though, is important for now. Already, not that long ago, less than 100 years ago, this halakha was accepted as absolute halakha across the board, by everyone. Less than 100 years ago, 1921, a woman by the name of Sarah Schneerer decided that this has to change. She went to all the rabbis of Eastern Europe to speak to them about it, and almost every single one of them told her, no way, it's asur. Only one or two agreed. It just happens to be that one of the two who agreed was the undisputed Gadol Hador, the Chafetz Chaim, who basically overruled everyone else over strong objections and said, we have to teach women Torah. He had certain conditions that many of us no longer follow either. A lot has happened. A lot has happened. But because it's happened so fast and because we get so involved in our inner disputes, I don't know if anybody here fully appreciates the radical change that's happened in less than 100 years, which in Jewish history is nothing. There is not an Orthodox community in the world. I don't care if it's the most, whatever you consider left-wing, barely Orthodox, or the most right-wing, Hasidic, whatever. There isn't a community in the world, an Orthodox community in the world, that doesn't have an entire school system where they teach every single one of their daughters Torah, exactly what they teach, exactly how they teach it, from what text, yes or no. Those are all details. Everybody has accepted that this is halacha that no longer applies. And again, why that is outside the box of this discussion. Maybe I'm doing injustice by that, because I certainly don't want people to walk out of here with the idea that we can flippantly decide, you know, whatever we want to do or don't want to do. But I do want to make the point that that this is something that, again, and how many things can you say this about? It is unanimously something, and it's interesting if you think about it, because a lot of people would assume that the question of women learning Torah is one of the most controversial issues in Orthodox Judaism, and perhaps it is when you come to the details, but it is unanimously agreed by Poskim across the board, and on how many issues can you say that? It is unanimously agreed by Poskim across the board that for one reason or another, in one way or another, this halacha and Shulchan Aruch does not apply any longer, and we all teach our daughters Torah. And therefore, you have a situation where halacha, which was not a deoraita, and that's the beginning, and that doesn't mean you can go and change derabbanans either. There's a lot more to this than that, but I'm just showing you that there are certain, as soon as something is a halacha that's based on either the application of the principle to contemporary reality or something else, then we have to look and see that if the causes which led to this psak halacha have changed, then the psak halacha changes accordingly, in some cases in very dramatic ways. Which means, and with this I'll sum up and take all questions and comments for as long as anybody wants to stay here, I'm happy to stay as long as necessary. I think what we've come to is the following. The Torah is not egalitarian by the standards of today's society. In other words, the principle that everybody has to have exactly the same status under the law, and that there's no such thing as separate but equal, the Torah definitely doesn't say that. It doesn't. The Torah definitely says that on certain issues, a minority of issues, but on certain issues, men and women, and also others, Kohanim and non-Kohanim, and all sorts of other distinctions that the Torah makes, people have status, in some cases as a result of their birth, gender or otherwise, and the Torah assigns different statuses on certain issues to different people. The Torah has always insisted, and the rabbis have always insisted, on respect for women and on treating women fairly in all sorts of ways. There are some halachot that appear patriarchal, but really aren't, just because of the context in which the laws were formulated. When you look at them, like the one we sampled from the laws of Ketubot, really aren't patriarchal at all. There are others, like the prohibition on learning Torah, where a law that at one point said this is an area that women have to be barred from, poskei halacha unanimously now say that's not true, even if they disagree about the details. And there are things, though, that are from the Torah that are like, for example, the prohibition on women being dayanot, that or eidim, that are universal and seem to be part of what God wants. And I, for one, am fine with that as long as we make sure that the system produces fair results. Two final sentences, and then anyone wants to leave can leave, and anyone wants to ask questions can ask questions, and I'll stay as long as necessary. Or argue with me. I'm happy to argue with anybody. I really do like arguing. Machlok el Hashem Shemayim, of course. Two last sentences. One, I think it's important to note that, again, without discussing the details of the current controversy, but the two examples that I chose here of something that can't change and something that does change, namely the fact that a woman cannot be a dayan, and women used to not learn Torah, but now they do, those two issues are at the center of the current controversy over women rabbis, or whatever we're going to call them, or if they can be anything, because this is really where it's coming from. It's coming from the fact that a few generations ago, we started teaching women Torah, and we now, Baruch Hashem, have gotten to the point that we have some women who are really scholarly and are leading and want to assume roles that they have not been able to assume in the past and are now should be able to assume roles that they haven't been able to assume in the past. And yet there are other roles that they can't, and they've both been called rabbi, and what do we do about all that? This is the starting point where it's coming from. And the other point of where it's coming from, which I haven't discussed, and I'm not going to discuss tonight either, but it needs to be just mentioned, is that if changes are going to be made of any sort, then we need to ask who has the authority to make those changes, and what the role of, you know, the people are, you know, what things should be done through blog posts and Facebook likes and things like that, and what decisions need to be taken only by the Gedolei Hador or the Poskim or people who, and what qualifications one needs to have what level of authority in that process. That's also a lot of what the current debate is about. That's the topic also of another shiur. I hope I've shed some light on the issue. I hope I've made some say there, and I'd love to hear what you think about what I've said. So.